Tish, says Bonnie very quietly, with a dreadful quietness. I almost know what he is going to say.
Yes?
Don't ever try to protect me again. Don't do that.
I know I am saying the wrong thing. But you were trying to protect me.
It's not, he says with the same terrifying quietness. The same thing, Tish.
And he suddenly takes the bag of tomatoes and smashes them against the nearest wall.
Thank God the wall is blank. Thank God it is now beginning to be dark. Thank God tomatoes spatter, but do not ring.
I know what he is saying. I know he is right. I know I must not say anything. Thank God he does not let go my hand. I look down at the sidewalk, which I cannot see. I hope he cannot hear my tears. But he does. He stops and turns me to him and he kisses me. He pulls away and looks at me and kisses me again.
Don't think I don't know you love me. You believe we're going to make it?
Then I am calm. There are tears on his face, his or mine, I don't know. I kiss him where our tears fall. I start to say something. He puts one finger on my lips. He smiles his little smile.
Hush. Don't say a word. I'm gonna take you out to dinner at our Spanish place, you remember? Only this time, it's gotta be on credit.
And he smiles, and I smile, and we keep on walking.
We have no money, Fanny says to Pedrocito, when we enter the restaurant. But we are very hungry, and I will have some money in a couple of days. In a couple of days, says Pedrocito furiously. That is what they all say. And furthermore, striking an incredulous hand to his forehead, I suppose that you would like to eat sitting down.
Why, yes, says Fanny, grinning. If you could arrange it, that would be nice.
At a table, no doubt.
And he stares at Fanny as though he simply cannot believe his eyes.
Well, I would, yeah, like a table.
Ah, but good evening, señorita, Pedrocito now says and smiles at me. It is for her I do it, you know.
He informs Fanny. It is clear that you do not feed her properly.
He leads us to a table and sits us down.
And now, no doubt, he scowls, you would like two margaritas. Caught me again, says Fanny.
And he and Pedrocito laugh, and Pedrocito disappears. Fanny takes my hand in his. Hello, he says. I say, hello.
I don't want you to feel bad about what I said to you before. You a fine, tough chick, and I know, hadn't been for you, my brains might be being spattered all over that precinct basement by now.
He pauses and he lights a cigarette. I watch him.
So, I don't mean that you did nothing wrong. I guess you did the only thing you could have done. But you gotta understand where I'm coming from.
He takes my hands between his again.
We live in a nation of pigs and murderers. I'm scared every time you out of my sight. And maybe what happened just now was my fault, because I should never have left you alone at that vegetable stand. But I was just so happy, you know, about the loft. I wasn't thinking.
Fanny, I've been to that vegetable stand 100 times, and nothing like that ever happened before. I've got to take care of you, of us. You can't go everywhere I go. How is it your fault? That was just some broken-down junkie.
Some broken-down white American, Fanny says,
Well, it's still not your fault.
He smiles at me.
They got us in a trick bag, baby. It's hard, but I just want for you to bear in mind that they can make us lose each other by putting me in the shit. Or they can try to make us lose each other by making you try to protect me from it. You see what I mean?
Yes, I say finally. I see what you mean. And I know that that's true.
Pedrocito returns with our margaritas.
We have a specialty tonight, he announces. Very, very Spanish. And we are trying it out on all those customers who think Franco is a great man.
He looks at Fanny quizzically.
I suppose that you do not exactly qualify, so for you, I will remove the arsenic. Without the arsenic, it is a little less strong, but it is actually very good. I think you will like it. Do you trust me not to poison you? Anyway, it would be very foolish of me to poison you before you pay your tremendous bill. We would immediately go bankrupt.
He turns to me.
Will you trust me, señorita? I assure you that we will prepare it with love. Now, watch it, Pete, says Fanny. Oh, your mind is like a sewer. You do not deserve so beautiful a girl.
And he disappears again.
That cop,
Fanny says.
That cop.
What about that cop? But I am suddenly, and I don't know why, as still and as dry as a stone, with fear.
He's going to try to get me,
Fanny says.
How? You didn't do anything wrong. The Italian lady said so, and she said that she would swear to it.
That's why he's going to try to get me,
Fanny says.
White men don't like it at all when a white lady tells them you a boat full of motherfuckers, and the black cat was right and you can kiss my ass.
He grins,
because that's what she told him in front of a whole lot of people, and he couldn't do shit, and he ain't about to forget it.
Well, I say, we'll soon be moving downtown to our loft.
That's right,
he says, and smiles again. Pedrocito arrives with our specialties. When two people love each other, when they really love each other, everything that happens between them has something of a sacramental air. They can sometimes seem to be driven very far from each other. I know of no greater torment, no more resounding void. When your lover has gone. But tonight, with our vows so mysteriously menaced, and with both of us, though from different angles, placed before this fact, we were more profoundly together than we had ever been before. Take care of each other, Joseph had said. You're going to find out it's more than a notion. After dinner, and coffee. Pedrocito offered us brandy, and then he left us in the nearly empty restaurant. Fanny and I just sat there and sipped our brandy, talking a little, holding hands, digging each other. We finished our brandy. Fanny said,
shall we go?
Yes, I said, for I wanted to be alone with him, in his arms. He signed the check, the last check he was ever to sign there. I have never been allowed to pay it. It has been, they say, misplaced. We said goodnight and we walked home with our arms around each other. There was a patrol car parked across the street from our house, and as Fanny opened our gate and unlocked our door, it drove off. Fanny smiled, but said nothing. I said nothing. The baby was conceived that night. I know it. I know it from the way Fani touched me, held me, entered me. I had never been so open before. And when he started to pull out, I would not let him. I held on to him as tightly as I could, crying and moaning and shaking with him, and felt life, life, his life inundating me, entrusting itself to me. Then we were still. We did not move because we could not. We held each other so close that we might indeed have been one body. Fani caressed me and called my name, and he fell asleep. I was very proud. I had crossed my river. Now we were one. Sharon gets to Puerto Rico on an evening plane. She knows exactly how much money she has, which means that she knows how rapidly she must move against time, which is inexorably moving against her. She steps down from the plane with hundreds of others and crosses the field under the blue-black sky, and something in the way the stars hang low, something in the way the air caresses her skin, reminds her of that Birmingham she has not seen in so long. She has brought with her only a small overnight bag, so she need not wait in line for her luggage. Hayward has made a reservation for her in a small hotel in San Juan, and he has written the address on a piece of paper. He has warned her that it may not be so easy to find a taxi. But he has not, of course, been able to prepare her for the stunning confusion which reigns at the San Juan airport. So Sharon stands still for a moment, trying to sort things out. She is wearing a green summer dress, my mother, and a wide-brimmed green cloth hat, her handbag over her shoulder, her overnight bag in her hand. She studies the scene. Her first impression is that everyone appears to be related to each other. This is not because of the way they look, nor is it a matter of language. It is because of the way they relate to each other. There are many colors here, but this does not, at least at the airport, appear to count for very much. Whoever is speaking is shouting. That is the only way to be heard, and everyone is determined to be heard. It is quite impossible to guess who is leaving, who arriving. Entire families appear to have been squatting there for weeks, with all their earthly possessions piled around them. Not, Sharon notes, that these possessions towered very high. For the children, the airport appears to be merely a more challenging way of playing house. Sharon's problems are real and deep. Since she cannot allow these to become desperate, she must now rely on what she can establish of illusion. And the key to illusion is complicity. The world sees what it wishes to see, or, when the chips are down, what you tell it to see. It does not wish to see who or what or why you are. Only Sharon knows that she is my mother. Only she knows what she is doing in San Juan, with no one to meet her. Before speculation rises too high, she must make it clear that she is a visitor, from up the road, from North America, who, through no fault of her own, speaks no Spanish. Sharon walks to the Hertz desk and stands there and smiles, somewhat insistently, at one of the young ladies behind the desk. "Do you speak English?" she asks the young lady. The young lady, anxious to prove that she does, looks up, determined to be helpful. Sharon hands her the address of the hotel. The young lady looks at it, looks back at Sharon. Her look makes Sharon realize that Hayward has been very thoughtful and that he has placed her in a very respected, respectable hotel. "I am very sorry to bother you," says Sharon, "but I do not speak any Spanish,
and I have had to come here unexpectedly. She pauses, giving no explanation. And I do not drive. I wondered if I could rent a car with a driver, or, if not, if you could tell me exactly how to get a taxi.
Sharon makes a helpless gesture. You see?
She smiles, and the young lady smiles. She looks again at the paper, looks around the airport, narrowing her eyes.
One moment, signora, she says.
She leaves her phone off the hook, swings open the small gate, closes it behind her, and disappears. She reappears very quickly with a boy of about 18.
This is your taxi driver, she says. He will take you where you are going.
She reads the address aloud and gives the piece of paper back to Sharon. She smiles.
I hope you will enjoy your visit, signora. If you need anything, allow me.
She gives Sharon her card.
If you need anything, please do not hesitate to call on me.
Thank you, says Sharon. Thank you very much. You have been beautiful.
It was nothing. Jaime,
she says authoritatively, take the lady's bag. Jaime does so, and Sharon says goodnight and follows Jaime. Sharon thinks, one down, and begins to be frightened. But she has to make her choices very quickly. On the way into town, she decides, because he is there, to make friends with Jaime and to depend, or to seem to depend, on him. He knows the town, and he can drive. It is true that he is terribly young, but that could turn out to be a plus. Someone older, knowing more, might turn out to be a terrible hassle. Her idea is to case the nightclub to see Pietro and possibly Victoria without saying anything to them. But it is not a simple matter for a lone woman, black or white, to walk unescorted into a nightclub. Furthermore, for all she knows, this nightclub may be a whorehouse. Her only option is to play the American tourist, wide-eyed. But she is black, and this is Puerto Rico. Only she knows that she's my mother, and about to become a grandmother. Only she knows that she is past 40. Only she knows what she is doing here. She tips Jaime when they arrive at the hotel. Then, as her bag is carried into the hotel, she looks suddenly at her watch.
My God, she says, do you think you could wait for me just for a minute while I register? I had no idea it was so late. I promised to meet someone. I won't be a moment. The boy will carry the bag up. Will that be all right?
Jaime is a somewhat muddy-faced boy with brilliant eyes and a sullen smile. He is entirely intrigued by this improbable North American lady, intrigued because he knows, through unutterably grim experience, that though she may be in trouble and certainly has a secret, she is not attempting to do him any violence. He understands that she needs him, the taxi, for something, but that is not his affair. He does not know he knows it. The thought has not consciously entered his mind. But he knows she is a mother. He has a mother. He knows one when he sees one. He knows again without knowing that he knows it, that he can be of service to her tonight. His courtesy is as real as her trouble. And so he says gravely that, of course, he will take the signora wherever she wishes and wait for her as long as she likes. Sharon cheats on him a little. She registers, goes up in the elevator with the bellboy, tips him. She cannot decide whether to wear her hat or not. Her problem is both trivial and serious, but she has never had to confront it before. Her problem is that she does not look her age. She takes her hat off. She puts it back on. Does the hat make her look younger or older? At home, she looks her age, whatever that age is, because everybody knows her age. She looks her age because she knows her role. But now she is about to enter a nightclub in a strange town for the first time in 20 years alone. She puts the hat on. She takes it off. She realizes that panic is about to overtake her, and so she throws the hat onto the night table, scrubs her face in cold water as harshly as she once scrubbed mine, puts on a high-necked white blouse and a black skirt and black high-heeled shoes, pulls her hair cruelly back from her forehead, knots it, and throws a black shawl over her head and shoulders. The intention of all this is to make her look elderly. The effect is to make her look juvenile. Sharon curses, but the taxi is waiting. She grabs her handbag, runs to the elevator, walks swiftly through the lobby, and gets to the taxi. She certainly, anyway, Jaime's brilliant eyes inform her, looks like a Yankee or a gringo tourist. The nightclub is located in what was certainly a backwater, if not indeed a swamp, before the immense hotel which houses it was built. It is absolutely hideous, so loud, so blatant, so impervious and cruel, that facing it causes mere vulgarity to seem an irrecoverable state of grace. Sharon is now really frightened. Her hands are shaking. She lights a cigarette. I must find someone, she says to Jaime. I will not be long. She has no way of realizing at that moment that the entire militia would have trouble driving Jaime away. Sharon has now become his property. This lady, he knows, is in deep trouble, and it is not an ordinary trouble. Because this is a lady. Certainly, senora, says Jaime with a smile, and gets out of the cab and comes to open the door for her. Thank you, Sharon says, and walks quickly toward the garish doors, wide open. There is no doorman visible, but there will certainly be a doorman inside. Now it must all be played by ear. And all that holds her up, my mother, who once dreamed of being a singer, is her private knowledge of what she is doing in this place. She enters, in fact, the hotel lobby, keys, registration, mail, cashier, board clerks, mainly white and decidedly pale, with no one paying her the slightest attention. She walks as though she knows exactly where she is going. The nightclub is on the left, down a flight of stairs. She turns left and walks down the stairs. No one has stopped her yet.
Señorita?
She has never seen a photograph of Pietro. The man before her is bland and swarthy. The light is too dim and her surroundings too strange for her to be able to guess his age. He does not seem unfriendly. Sharon smiles. Good evening. I hope I'm in the right place. This is... And she stammers the name of the nightclub.
Sí, señorita.
Well, I'm supposed to meet a friend here, but the flight I meant to take was overbooked, and so I was forced to take an earlier one. So I'm a little early. Could you hide me at a table in a corner somewhere?
Certainly, with pleasure.
He leads her through the crowded room.
What is the name of your friend?
Her mind dries up. She must go for broke. It's actually more in the nature of business. I am waiting for a Señor Alvarez. I am Mrs. Rivers from New York.
Thank you.
He seats her at a table against the wall.
Will you have a drink while waiting?
Yes, thank you. A screwdriver. He bows, whoever he is, and walks away.
Two down, thinks Sharon.
And she is now very calm. This is a nightclub, and so the music is live. Sharon's days with the drummer come back to her. Her days as a singer come back to her. They do not, as she is to make very vivid to me, much later, come back with the rind of regret. She and the drummer lost each other. That was that. She was not equipped to be a singer, and that was that. Yet she remembers what she and the drummer and the band attempted. She knows from whence they came. If I remember Uncloudy Day, because I remember myself sitting on my mother's knee when I first heard it, she remembers My Lord and I. And so we'll walk together, my Lord and I. That song is Birmingham, her father and her mother, the kitchens and the mines. She may never, in fact, ever have particularly liked that particular song, but she knows about it. It is a part of her. She slowly realizes that this is the song which, to different words, if words indeed there are, the young people on the bandstand are belting or bolting out. And they know nothing at all about the song they are singing, which causes Sharon to wonder if they know anything about themselves at all. This is the first time that Sharon has been alone in a very long time. Even now, she is alone merely physically, in the same way, for example, that she is alone when she goes shopping for her family. Shopping, she must listen, she must look, say yes to this, say no to that, she must choose. She has a family to feed. She cannot poison them because she loves them. And now she finds herself listening to a sound she has never heard before. If she were shopping, she could not take this home and put it on the family table, for it would not nourish them. "My gal and I," cries the undernourished rock singer, whipping himself into an electronic orgasm. But no one who had ever had a lover, a mother, or father, or a lord could sound so despairingly masturbatory. For it is despair that Sharon is hearing, and despair, whether or not it can be taken home and placed on the family table, must always be respected. Despair can make one monstrous, but it can also make one noble. And here these children are, in the arena, up for grabs. Sharon claps for them, because she prays for them. Her screwdriver comes, and she smiles up at a face she cannot see. She sips her drink. She stiffens. The children are about to go into their next number, and she looks up into another face she cannot see. The children begin their number, loud. "I can't get no satisfaction."
"You Mrs. Rivers, you waiting for me?"
"I think so. Won't you sit down?" He sits down, facing her. Now she sees him. Again, thinking of me and Fanny and the baby, cursing herself for being so inept, knowing herself to be encircled, trapped, her back to the wall, his back to the door, she yet must go for broke. "I was told that a certain Mr. Pietro Alvarez worked here. Are you Pietro Alvarez?" She sees him, and yet, of course, at the same time, she doesn't.
"Maybe. What you want to see him about?"
Sharon wants a cigarette, but she is afraid her hands will tremble. She picks up her screwdriver in both hands and sips it, slowly, rather thanking God now for the shawl which she can maneuver to shadow her face. If she can see him, he can also see her. She is silent for a moment. Then she puts down her drink and she picks up a cigarette. "May I have a light, please?" He lights it. She takes off the shawl.
"I do not especially want to see Mr. Alvarez. I want to see Mrs. Victoria Rogers. I am the mother-in-law to be, of the man she has accused of raping her, and who is now in prison in New York. She watches him. He watches her. Now she begins to see him.
Well, lady, you got one hell of a son-in-law, let me tell you that.
I also have one hell of a daughter, let me tell you that. The mustache he has grown to make him look older twitches. He runs his hands through his thick black hair.
Look, the kid's been through enough, more than enough. Leave her alone.
A man is about to die for something he didn't do. Can we leave him alone?
What makes you think he didn't do it?
Look at me. The children on the bandstand finish their set and go off, and immediately the jukebox takes over. Ray Charles, I Can't Stop Loving You.
What you want me to look at you for?
The waiter comes. What are you drinking, senor? Sharon put out her cigarette and immediately lights another.
It's on me. Give me the usual, and give the lady what she's drinking.
The waiter goes. Look at me.
I'm looking at you.
Do you think I love my daughter?
Frankly, it's hard to believe you have a daughter.
I'm about to become a grandmother.
From?
Yes. He is young, very, very young, but also very old, but not old in the way she had expected him to be. She had expected the age of corruption. She is confronting the age of sorrow. She is confronting torment. Do you think that I would marry my daughter to a rapist?
You might not know.
Look at me again. And he does, but it does not help him.
Look, I wasn't there, but Victoria swears it was him. And she's been through shit, baby. She's been through some shit. And I don't want to put her through no more. I'm sorry, lady, but I don't care what happens to your daughter.
He stops.
She's going to have a baby?
Yes.
What you want from me? Can't you leave us alone? We just want to be left alone.
Sharon says nothing.
Look. I ain't no American. You got all them lawyers and folks up there. Why you coming to me? Shit, I'm sorry, but I ain't nothing. I'm an Indian. Wop, stick, spade, name it, that's me. I got my little thing going here, and I got Victoria. And lady, I don't want to put her through no more shit. I'm sorry, lady, but I really just can't help you.
He starts to rise. He does not want to cry before her. Sharon takes his wrist. He sits down, one hand before his face. Sharon takes out her wallet. Pietro,
I can call you that because I am old enough to be your mother. My son-in-law is your age.
He leans his head on one hand and looks at her. Sharon hands him the photograph of Fanny and myself. Look at it. He does not want to, but he does. Are you a rapist? He looks up at her.
Answer me. Are you?
The dark eyes in the stolid face, staring now directly into my mother's eyes, make the face electrical, light a fire in the darkness of a far-off hill. He has heard the question. Are you?
No.
Do you think I have come here to make you suffer?
No.
Do you think I am a liar? No. Do you think I am crazy? We are all a little crazy, I know.
but really crazy.
No.
Then, will you take this photograph home to Victoria and ask her really to think about it, really to study it? Hold her in your arms. Do that. I am a woman. I know that she was raped, and I know, well, I know what women know. But I also know that Alonzo did not rape her. And I say that to you because I know that you know what men know. Hold her in your arms. She stares at him an instant. He stares at her. And will you call me tomorrow? She gives him the name and the phone number of the hotel. He writes it down. Will you? He looks at her, now very hard and cold. He looks at the phone number. He looks at the photograph. He pushes both toward Sharon. No, he says, and rises and leaves. Sharon sits there. She listens to the music. She watches the dancers. She forces herself to finish her second unwanted drink. She cannot believe that what is happening is actually happening, but it is happening. She lights a cigarette. She is acutely aware not merely of her color, but of the fact that in the sight of so many witnesses, her position, ambiguous upon her entrance, is now absolutely clear. The 22-year-old boy she has traveled so far to see has just walked out on her. She wants to cry. She also wants to laugh. She signals for the waiter. See? What do I owe you? The waiter looks bewildered. But nothing, signora. Señor Alvarez has made himself responsible. She realizes that his eyes hold neither pity nor scorn. This is a great shock to her, and it brings tears to her eyes. To hide this, she bows her head and arranges her shawl. The waiter moves away. Sharon leaves $5 on the table. She walks to the door. The bland, swarthy man opens it for her.
Thank you, señora. Good night. Your taxi is waiting for you. Please come again.
Thank you, my mother says, and smiles and walks up the stairs. She walks through the lobby. Jaime is leaning against the taxi. His face brightens when he sees her, and he opens the door for her.
What time will you need me tomorrow? He asks her.
Is 9 o'clock too early?
Well, no, he laughs. I'm always up before 6.
The car begins to move.
Beautiful, says Sharon, swinging her foot, thinking ahead.
And the baby starts kicking, waking me up at night. Now that Mama is in Puerto Rico, it is Ernestine and Joseph who keep watch over me. I am afraid to quit my job because I know we need the money. This means that I very often miss the 6 o'clock visit. It seems to me that if I quit my job, I'll be making the 6 o'clock visit forever. I explain this to Fonny, and he says he understands, and in fact he does, but understanding doesn't help him at 6 o'clock. No matter what you understand, you can't help waiting for your name to be called, to be taken from your cell and led downstairs. If you have visitors, or even if you have only one visitor, but that visitor is constant, it means that someone outside cares about you, and this can get you through the night into the day. No matter what you may understand and really understand, and no matter what you may tell yourself, if no one comes to see you, you are in very bad trouble. And trouble here means danger. Joseph puts it to me very squarely one Sunday morning.
I have been more than usually sick that morning, and Joseph has had to tend to me because Ernestine has a rush job at the home of the actress. I cannot imagine what this thing inside of me is doing, but it appears to have acquired feet. Sometimes it is still, for days on end, sleeping perhaps, but more probably plotting its escape. Then it turns, beating the water, churning, obviously becoming unspeakably bored in this element, and wanting out. We are beginning to have a somewhat acrid dialogue, this thing and I. It kicks, and I smash an egg on the floor. It kicks, and suddenly the coffee pot is upside down on the table. It kicks, and the perfume on the back of my hand brings salt to the roof of my mouth, and my free hand weighs on the heavy glass counter with enough force to crack it in two. God damn it. Be patient. I'm doing the best I can. And it kicks again, delighted to have elicited so furious a response. Please, be still. And then, exhausted, or as I suspect, merely cunning, it is still. Having covered my forehead with sweat and having caused me to vomit up my breakfast and go to the bathroom uselessly about 4 or 5 times. But it really is very cunning. It intends to live. It never moves while I am riding the subway or when I am crossing a crowded street. But it grows heavier and heavier. Its claims become more absolute with every hour. It is, in fact, staking its claim. The message is that it does not so much belong to me, though there is another, gentler kick, usually at night, signifying that it has no objection to belonging to me, that we may even grow to be fond of each other as I belong to it. And then it hauls off again like Muhammad Ali, and I am on the ropes. I do not recognize my body at all. It is becoming absolutely misshapen. I try not to look at it because I simply do not recognize it. Furthermore, I sometimes take something off in the evening and have difficulty getting back into it in the morning. I can no longer wear high heels. They distort my sense of balance as profoundly as one's vision is distorted if one is blind in one eye. I have never had breasts or a behind, but I am beginning to have them now. It seems to me that I am gaining weight at the rate of about 300 pounds an hour, and I do not dare speculate on what I will probably look like by the time this thing inside of me finally kicks itself out. Lord. And yet, we are beginning to know each other, this thing, this creature. And I. And sometimes we are very, very friendly. It has something to say to me, and I must learn to listen. Otherwise, I will not know what to say when it gets here. And Fanny would never forgive me for that. After all, it was I who wanted this baby more than he. And at a depth beneath and beyond all our troubles, I am very happy. I can scarcely smoke at all anymore. It has seen to that. I have acquired a passion for cocoa and donuts, and brandy is the only alcohol which has any taste at all. So Ernestine casually brings over a few bottles from the actress's house. She'll never miss them, baby, the way they drink. On this Sunday morning, Joseph serves me my third cup of cocoa, the previous two having been kicked right back up, and sits down at the table before me, very stern.
Do you want to bring this baby here or not?
The way he looks at me and the way he sounds scares me half to death. Yes, I say, I do.
And you love Fanny?
Yes, I do.
Then, I'm sorry. But you're going to have to quit your job.
I watch him.
I know you worried about the money, but you let me worry about that. I got more experience. Anyway, you ain't making no damn money. All you doing is wearing yourself out and driving Fonny crazy. You keep on like you going, you're gonna lose that baby. You lose that baby and Fonny won't want to live no more. And you'll be lost and then I'll be lost. Everything is lost.
He stands up and walks to the window, his back to me. Then he faces me again.
I'm serious, Tish.
I say, I know you are. Joseph smiles.
Listen, little girl, we got to take care of each other in this world, right? Now, there are some things I can do that you can't do, that's all. There's things I can do that you can't do, and things you can do that I can't do. Just like I can't have your baby for you. I would if I could. There's nothing I wouldn't do for you. You know that.
And he watches me, still smiling. Yes, I know that.
And there are things you can do for Fonny that I can't do, right?
Yes. Joseph walks up and down the kitchen.
Young folks hate to hear this. I did when I was young. But you are young. Child, I wouldn't lose neither one of you for all the goddamn coffee in Brazil, but you young. Fonny ain't hardly much more than a boy, and he's in trouble no boy should be in. And you all he's got, Tish. You are all he's got. I'm a man, and I know what I'm talking about. You understand me?
Yes. He sits down before me again.
You got to see him. Every day, Tish. Every day. You take care of Fonny. We'll take care of the rest, all right?
All right. He kisses my tears.
Get that baby here, safe and sound. We'll get Fonny out of jail. I promise. Do you promise?
I smile. And I say, yes, I promise. The next morning, I am, anyway, far too ill to be able to go to work. And Ernestine calls the store to tell them so. She says that she or I will be coming in to collect my paycheck in the next few days. So, that is that. And here we go. There is a level on which, if I'm to be honest, I must say that I absolutely hated it, having nothing to do. But this forced me to recognize finally that I had clung to my job in order to avoid my trouble. Now I was alone with Fonny, my baby, and me. But Joseph was right, and Fonny is radiant. On the days I do not see Hayward, I see Fonny twice a day. I am always there for the 6 o'clock visit, and Fonny knows that I will be there. It is very strange, and I now begin to learn a very strange thing. My presence, which is of no practical value whatever, which can even be considered from a practical point of view as a betrayal, is vastly more important than any practical thing I might be doing. Every day when he sees my face, he knows again that I love him. And God knows I do more and more, deeper and deeper with every hour. But it isn't only that. It means that others love him too. Love him so much that they have set me free to be there. He is not alone. We are not alone. And if I am somewhat terrified by the fact that I no longer have anything which can be called a waistline, he is delighted.
Here she come, big as two houses. You sure it ain't twins or triplets? Shit, we might make history.
Throwing back his head, holding on to the telephone, looking me in the eye. Laughing.
and I understand that the growth of the baby is connected with his determination to be free. So, I don't care if I get to be as big as two houses. The baby wants out, Fonny wants out, and we are going to make it in time. Jaime is prompt, and Sharon is in the favela by 9:30. Jaime knows the location roughly of the particular dwelling, but he does not know the lady, at least he is not sure that he does. He is still thinking about it when Sharon steps out of the taxi. Hayward had tried to warn Sharon by telling her that he had never been able to describe a favela and that he very much doubted if after her visit, she would wish to try. It is bitter. The blue sky above and the bright sun, the blue sea here, the garbage dump there. It takes a moment to realize that the garbage dump is the favela. Houses are built on it, dwellings, some on stilts, as though attempting to rise above the dung heap. Some have corrugated metal roofs. Some have windows. All have children. Jaime walks beside Sharon, proud to be her protector, uneasy about the errand. The smell is fantastic, but the children, sliding up and down their mountain, making the air ring, dark, half-naked with their brilliant eyes, their laughter, splashing into and out of the sea, do not seem to care. This ought to be the place, Jaime says, and Sharon steps through an archway into a crumbling courtyard. The house which faces her must have been at some point in time an extremely important private dwelling. It is not private now. Generations of paint flake off the walls, and the sunlight, which reveals every stain and crack, does not deign to enter the rooms, some of which are shuttered to the extent that is, that the shutters hold. It is louder than an untrained orchestra in rehearsal, and the sound of infants and children is the theme. Tremendously developed in extraordinary harmonies in the voices of the elders. There seem to be doors everywhere, low, dark, and square. I think it might be here, Jaime says nervously, and he points to one of the doors. On the third floor, I think. You say she is blonde? Sharon looks at him. He is absolutely miserable. He does not want her to go upstairs alone. She touches his face and smiles. He suddenly reminds her of Fonny, brings back to her why she is here. Wait for me, she says. Don't worry, I won't be long. And she walks through the door and climbs the steps as though she knows exactly where she is going. There are four doors on the third floor. There are no names on any of them. One of them is a little open, and she knocks on it, opening it a little further as she knocks. Mrs. Rogers? A very thin girl with immense dark eyes in a dark face, wearing a flowered house dress, barefoot, steps into the middle of the room. Her curly hair is a muddy blonde, high cheekbones, thin lips, wide mouth. A gentle, vulnerable, friendly face. A gold crucifix burns against her throat. She says, Signora? And then stands still, staring at Sharon with her great eyes, frightened. Signora? For Sharon has said nothing, merely stands in the doorway watching her. The girl's tongue moistens her lips. She says again, Signora. She does not look her age. She looks like a little girl. Then she moves and the light strikes her differently, and Sharon recognizes her. Sharon leans against the open door, really afraid for a moment that she will fall. Mrs. Rogers? The girl's eyes narrow, her lips curl. No, Senora, you are mistaken. I am Sanchez. They watch each other. Sharon is still leaning against the door. The girl makes a movement toward the door as though to close it, but she does not wish to push Sharon. She does not want to touch her. She takes one step. She stops. She touches the crucifix at her throat, staring at Sharon. Sharon cannot read the girl's face. There is concern in it. Not unlike Jaime's concern. There is terror in it, too, and a certain covered, terrified sympathy. Sharon, still not absolutely certain that she can move, yet senses that whether she can move or not, it is better not to change her position against the open door. It gives her some kind of advantage.
Excuse me, Senora, but I have work to do, if you please. I don't know any Mrs. Rogers. Maybe in one of the other places around here?
She smiles faintly and looks toward the open window.
But there are so many. You will be looking for a long time.
She looks at Sharon with bitterness. Sharon straightens and they are abruptly looking each other in the eye, each held now by the other.
I have a photograph of you, says Sharon.
The girl says nothing. She attempts to look amused. Sharon takes out the photograph and holds it up. The girl walks toward the door. As she advances, Sharon moves from the door into the room.
Senora, I have told you that I have my work to do.
She looks Sharon up and down.
I am not a North American lady.
I am not a lady. I am Mrs. Rivers.
And I am Mrs. Sanchez. What did you want with me? I do not know you.
I know you don't know me. Maybe you've never even heard of me.
Something happens in the girl's face. She tightens her lips, rummages in the pockets of her house coat for her cigarettes, blowing the smoke insolently toward Sharon. Yet,
would you have a cigarette, Senora?
And she extends the package toward Sharon. There is a plea in the girl's eyes, and Sharon, with a shaking hand, takes the cigarette and the girl lights it for her. She puts the package back into the pocket of her house coat.
I know you don't know me, but I think you must have heard of me.
The girl looks briefly at the photograph in Sharon's hand, looks at Sharon and says nothing.
I met Pietro last night.
Ah, and did he give you the photograph?
She had meant this as sarcasm. Realizes that she made a mistake. Still, her defiant eyes seem to say, staring into Sharon's, there are so many Pietros.
No. I got it from the lawyer for Alonzo Hunt. The man you say raped you.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you do.
Look. I ain't got nothing against nobody, but I got to ask you to get out of here.
She is trembling and close to tears. She holds both dark hands clenched tightly before her, as though to prevent herself from touching Sharon.
I'm here to try to get a man out of prison. That man is going to marry my daughter, and he did not rape you.
She takes out the photograph of me and Fanny.
Look at it.
The girl turns away, again toward the window, sits down on the unmade bed, still staring out of the window. Sharon approaches her.
Look at it,
Please. The girl is my daughter. The man with her is Alonzo Hunt. Is this the man who raped you?
The girl will not look at the photograph or at Sharon.